We're continuing our study through the book of Ruth today. And as always, the notes are available to you in YouVersion. And if you're new to us, the little round icon there in the U, anytime you see that in the notes, that means in the notes on YouVersion, I've given you a little extra to study on that I just don't have time to unpack here today. So let me reset the scene for you in case you're new with this. Naomi and her husband, Elimelech, moved to Moab with two sons. And while in Moab, the husband and the two sons passed away. And they both had wives. And so Naomi had two daughter-in-laws, Orpah and Ruth. And she was coming back to Jerusalem. And she told her two daughter-in-laws not to come with her, but to stay in Moab, the land of their people. And one of them went back to her family. The other one, named Ruth, gave us one of the most precious, one of the most beautiful passages, in my humble opinion, in all the Bible, of commitment not only to Naomi, but to Naomi's God, the God Jehovah, where she said this, "And cause me not to leave you or to return from following you. For where you shall go, I shall go. And where you shall lodge, I shall lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God shall be my God." And so now these two ladies, brokenhearted, unsure of the future on many levels, begin to make their journey back to Bethlehem in Judea. And this is where we pick up the story. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. This is the same Bethlehem of Jesus' birth. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" She had been gone for at least 10 years and probably a little longer of a period. And when she comes home, the whole little village is abuzz. Is Naomi here? I mean, the Twitterverse is blowing up. Facebook is blowing up because Naomi has come back to Bethlehem. Now, when they on their arrival and in the process of traveling there, they would have probably gone north over the Dead Sea and come across the Jordan River and then up the mountains to Jerusalem and Bethlehem. And I thought about the critical conversation that Naomi might would have with Ruth. Now, how many of you have ever traveled overseas? Okay. Now, depending on where you're going, now listen, if you're just going to Cabo, you don't need no critical conversations. Don't drink the water and don't walk off alone. And if you see a shark, get out the water. I mean, that's all you need. But if you've ever gone someplace that's unfamiliar to you, perhaps culturally and things, there's this need for myself to talk about this. And so I thought about a critical conversation that Naomi needed to have with Ruth. And as we talk about this, I want you to take it out of the original context and also apply it into our context. Naomi and Ruth were going back to Bethlehem, but I want us to think about those that we are inviting into church to come into this place, to be with these people. Think about how difficult it could be or how scary maybe it would be if you've never been to church. Now, it doesn't mean you've never heard rumors about church. Now, here's the thing. How often do you hear good rumors about church? I mean, when you hear talk, and by this I mean gossip, when you hear talk about church, usually it can be a little iffy. Well, you know that preacher, he's long-winded. You know that preacher, all he wants is my money. You know those people at church, all they do is look and judge me. Don't worry about it. It's all going to be good. Do I get to preach till it stops raining? Because if you didn't bring a bumper chute, you're going to get wet anyway. But having critical conversations with our friends, our family, our co-workers when it comes to spiritual things in church are very, very important. Please don't ever allow someone to come with you to church and never have had any discussion about what they may experience when they arrive. And so I see this critical conversation as they're moving along, and perhaps Naomi talked to her daughter-in-law about customs, because the Moabites and the Israelites were very different people. And they have different customs and they have different ways of dressing. And so if you're going to a place, you kind of want to have an idea of what you're walking into. Like in our church, we say, come as you are. And we mean it. You could come in shorts. You could come in a t-shirt. You can come without shoes. Just cover yourself up. Come as you are. Now, every church in this town and every other town will tell you, oh, you want to come visit our church for the time? Well, you just come as you are. Really? Okay. Now, you could come as you are the first time, but next time you need to wise up. Now, I'm not judging other churches. Everybody has the right to do what they want to do, okay? But here, we say, come as you are, and you know what? And we mean it. Help your friends understand that. Help them know that here, you know, there are things that we do, but, you know, help them to understand some of our customs. Help them understand some of your memories. Talk good about your church. Talk good about the wonderful memories that you have. That's an encouraging thing. Talk about faith. Naomi coming back and Ruth coming with her. Ruth was not an Israelite. Ruth had not ever studied Jehovah God. And so she needed to begin to help her understand this new belief system and what they do and why they do it and how they do it. It's very important. Don't let someone walk into church cold. Talk about your faith before they get here with them, okay? And then also what might be asked of them or what might be thought about them. Now, coming back, the Moabites were enemies of the Israelites. And so you can imagine bringing a Moabite back in. You know what? There may be some people that just aren't very nice. And the truth is sometimes in church, there's some people that just aren't very nice. Amen? We all, yeah. Or, you know what, they may not be nice, but they just may not look nice. Have you ever been in church and you walk in and someone goes, and they're giving you the stink eye? You know, they don't have the courage to walk up and go, hey, I disagree with the way you're dressed. I may be wrong, but I'm just telling you, they just give you the stink eye. You know, you like that? Or the person that walks up says, hey, you're sitting in my seat. I give you permission. If anyone ever says that to you, say, well, you know what? There's a lot of other seats. Go on an adventure. But you see, critical conversations, we avoid them because they're a little uncomfortable. We avoid them because we're afraid of making a mistake. But when we avoid them, we're really robbing ourselves and those we may have them with of the opportunity of answering questions, sharing faith. It's a wonderful thing. Hey, listen, if your friend or your coworker has never had an interest in church or never had an interest in the Bible, and they say, hey, I may like to come with you, and you have these critical conversations, and they don't come with you, so what have you lost? But in that, you've had a chance to talk to them about what's dear and near to your heart. It's important. So I can imagine on the way, I hope that Naomi was coaching up Ruth in these critical conversations. And then we go on, verse 20. They get back and all the town's abuzz. Is this Naomi? Has Naomi came back? And then you know what happens is natural questions. Well, where's her husband? Can you imagine that buzz? Well, where's her sons? Oh, and then ladies, I mean, it is. Naomi came back and let's just say life had been a little hard on her, okay? Naomi looked a little weathered for life, okay? Now, I think you understand what I'm saying, but I'm trying to avoid that bear trap, right? Okay, a man cannot comment about a woman's looks without blowing his leg off. But they can see Naomi, not only are three men missing, not only is there this Moabite girl, but Naomi looks like life's been a little hard. And so the conversation begins to kind of generate around. And finally, someone comes up and they start talking to her, and this is the response. Naomi tells her friends and her family, do not call me Naomi, she told them, call me Mara. Now that translated means bitter. Now, how would you like this conversation? Someone walks up and they says, hey, it's good to see you again. It's good to see you, Heather. And Heather goes, don't call me Heather, call me bitter. Now, I can tell you what most men are doing. They go, all right. Now, you ladies, you're like, well, tell me about it. About three out of four of you. And then the fourth one's going, well, I wonder what made her bitter. Anyway. But But Naomi says, don't call me Naomi, call me bitter. Now that's a conversation in itself. And she says, tells him why. I went away full. Full in that she had a husband and two sons. I went away full, perhaps in a better physical condition. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Wow. That's a serious conversation right there. There's a critical conversation needing to be had here. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. Wow. Okay. So we need to determine first, as we go through life, is it a life challenge or is it God's discipline? Okay? Naomi is walking through this. She's trying to unpack this. And we always need to discern when challenges come into our lives. And listen, challenges come, don't they? They do. There's not one of us that escapes challenges. And we have to understand, is this a life challenge or is this a loving disciplinary action from God? Okay? And when we discern one or the other, then we can act upon it. Now, I don't have time to unpack it all, but I'll just give you a thumbnail test is this. Is if you know that you are living willfully disobedient to God and things seem to be a little tough going, it might be God's loving discipline, okay? If you can say in the quietness of your heart, I believe I'm doing all that I know, the best that I can, in obedience to God, it may just be a trial of life. Stuff happens. Listen, cars run out of gas. Okay? Now, when we realize, if we determine that it's just a trial of life, please don't give the devil all the credit. Every time something happens to you, it's not necessarily the devil. It's just life. If you run out of gas, it's because you didn't put gas in the car. The devil didn't sneak up to your house, siphon the gas out, and if you know what I'm saying, don't judge me for knowing how to borrow gas. He didn't take your gas needle and push it over to F when it's really on E. It's you. Don't give the devil more credit than he's due, all right? If it's a life challenge, then you have to respond to that. If it's God's loving discipline, then you have to respond to that. But please, give the devil a break. All right. He's not worthy of your attention. So now let's look when trials came. We touched on this a few weeks ago, but it bears plowing back over. There's three responses to the challenges of life or God's loving discipline, and we've seen them displayed. The first one is escape. We talked about when things get tough, we want to escape it. And there's a thousand ways of escaping. One of them you carry in your hand almost all the time. That little escape pill called your cell phone, okay? So Elimelech, which is Naomi's husband, faced a challenge, and you know what he did? Is he chose to escape. And this is how the process by which this decision can be made. Sometimes it's made in haste. Have you ever made a bad decision really quick? It's more often than not, if you make a real snap decision, it may be a bad decision. Now, don't hear me say that, you know, sometimes you just got to make a snap decision. You just got to do. But more often than not, you know, we probably have time to think about it. Secondly, it's made in hopes of producing something that God, you feel that God can't give you, or you know that God won't give you. An escape from discipline or escape from trial could be you're saying, God, I just don't think you have the ability to do what I want you to do. Or you could be saying, God, I know it's wrong, and I know you know it's wrong, and you're not going to give it to me anyway. And so we'll try to escape that way. Or thirdly, and sometimes a bad decision, an escape decision, is made out of a sense of helplessness. And do not hear me say, one, that if you ever find yourself feeling absolutely helpless, you're out of the will of God. That's not true. Life's hard sometimes, isn't it? And sometimes we can feel absolutely helpless. If you've ever stood in an ICU ward, if you've ever stood at a graveside, you understand what these things are like. Now the question is if we find ourselves in a sense of hopelessness, what do we do? Do we try to escape? Do we climb into the bottle? What do? Do we put the drugs in our body? What do? Well, God gives us a remedy for this. Psalms 21:21 tells us this. I lift my eyes to the mountains. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heavens and earth. When you feel helpless, don't run away. Run to Him. If you fall down and you sin, don't run away from the church. Run to the church. Hopeless is a state we all can find ourselves in. And if you haven't been there, that means you still have it to experience. It doesn't make you weak. It doesn't make you unspiritual. Listen, sometimes life just, man, it just eats you like crackers. But when those times come, we run to the Lord, not to the world's answers. Okay? We don't escape to the world. Second, our response can be escape. The second one can be endure. And that means you just gut it out. You just gut it out. You know, now I'm not opposed to a man pulling himself up by his bootstraps and just getting some grit on. I mean, that's awesome. But if all you ever do is just gut it out, you see, and that's what Naomi's doing. And you see, if all you ever do is gut it out, you're going to become bitter. Sooner or later, you're going to become bitter either at the individual or at the circumstance. And I'm going to tell you what, sooner or later, the walk's going to lead you to God. How do I know that? As an 11-year-old kid, I'm laying in a bed with traction. The next day, they put a body cast on me, which is purgatory or hell on earth, whichever one offends you the less. And you know who I cussed with every fiber of an 11-year-old kid could cuss? I didn't cuss my mother for drunk driving. I didn't cuss the police. I didn't cuss the doctor. I didn't cuss the surgeon. I didn't cuss the nurse. I cussed God. Because eventually, just gutting it out will lead you to the feet of God, and you will be bitter. Just gutting it out, just enduring isn't the answer. And then the third response, the biblical response, is to enlist the trials of life, to enlist the circumstances of life. You see, but we wrestle with that. Sometimes it's just too soon. Boy, I tell you, nothing gripes me more than to see a pastor at a funeral. Ecclesiastes tells us there's a time for everything. There's a time to weep. There's a time to mourn. There's time for everything. Amen? And nothing gripes my crackers more to hear a preacher standing at a funeral and say, well, you know, you just need to get over it. Well, to you. You know, you get over it, chief. That's my loved one. That's my nanny. That's get over it. Listen, sometimes the circumstance is too soon for us to be able to incorporate what God may have for us to learn in it. It's okay. Time is the greatest healer that we have. Sometimes people won't incorporate and enlist it because it's just too hard. I just need to tell you an honest fact this morning. Can I be honest with you? Living a life of faith is hard. It just simply is. And to enlist the things in life into our lives, it takes faith. And living a life of faith is hard. Then if anyone ever tells you that, they're just not being honest with you. Don't ever undersell the challenge of living a life of faith. Don't ever do it. I've seen preachers and I've heard teachers, and by the time you walk out of there, you think, man, if I buy this Jesus, it's all rose petals and chocolate. Well, I'm going to tell you what, I'd rather be in the valley with Jesus than without Him. But Jesus is going to be in the valley with me. You know why? Because I'm going to be in a valley. So sometimes it's just too hard. Faith. And here's the thing. It's much like physical strength. You do not get physical strength unless there's resistance to build the muscles. You will not ever be a champion of faith unless you've had your faith challenged. And then lastly, sometimes we can be just too immature. Now, I don't mean that in a derogatory way. You see, part of the necessity of discipleship as a Christian is that you can know God and that you can know God so that when the trials come, you can respond in faith to God. Sometimes a person can be just too immature to be able to enlist the difficulties or the discipline of God in their lives. Now, for me, when these times come, and they do, this is what I think of. I think of life like a toolbox. Romans 8:28 tells us, for we know, let's say that together, we know in all things, even you running out of gas. You know what we know? God's teaching you, put gas in the car. God works for good of those who love Him and who have been called according to His purposes. God takes these experiences, God takes His loving discipline, and when we respond to them properly, we put them in our toolbox, and it makes us prepared to be ministers to others. Would I wish that my mother is deceased? Absolutely not. Would I wish that my mother-in-law was lost to breast cancer? Absolutely not. Would I wish that my grandfather was lost to Alzheimer's and my father-in-law? Absolutely not. But you know what? I know what it's like to walk through those valleys. And God put those in my toolbox. And it's a beautiful thing when God redeems sorrow out of your life for something beautiful in the life of someone else, isn't it? All right, and here we go ahead. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as it was barley harvest season. Now, the beautiful thing about God is it's always harvest season. Joey, I gave the Korean students a little tour of Greenville yesterday. It was a short tour, but it was longer than touring commerce. And one of the things they were really amazed about was the granary, because I told them about, you know, our history of being, you know, cotton famous, all that. And I said, and I know the man that runs that. Oh. And I told him, and I said, now some say there's a spirit in there, and they go, oh, you know. So, but I've been in Kansas at harvest time, and I'm going to tell you what, that's a beautiful thing. And you look across those harvest fields, and it's a beautiful thing. And here's something I need you to know today, especially after being able to watch those baptisms, is that with God, it's always harvest time. No matter where you are, no matter what you're going through, no matter what day of the week it is, what hour of that day, God is always, always, always in harvest mode. And if you'll just step out by faith, you can establish a relationship with Him, and you can have the promises of His Word. You can be born again. God is always in harvest season. We also need to understand this, is that starting over is not the same thing as starting again. I've heard it said before, well, you know, if you stumble, just come back to Jesus and start over. No, you don't get to start over, because starting over means, one, is the consequences are negated. But we don't get that privilege, do we? If I stumble and fall, my knees are still skint. There may still be consequences. But the Bible says, as believers, when we repent, we can come back and we can start again. Now, not only are the consequences not negated, but if you're really, really smart, the lessons learned are not lost. You see, we all stumble and fall. But God is so loving, so gracious, and so mighty that He can take our failures and put value into our lives with them if we start over. It's like your little kiddos. They fall down and they dust up their knees, and you just pick them up and dust them off and go, oh, let's go on, let's go. Because you know you're going to fall down 1,000 times. So let's not make the mistake of thinking we can start over. We don't get to start over, but we do get to start anew. And then we see that starting again is a natural byproduct of the reoccurrence of failure. Now, every baseball player wants to bat 1,000. But it ain't ever been done. And they go up there, and you know what? And they're going to do their dead level best to do the best they can, knowing they're not going to bat 1,000. You and I know that there's only been one who batted a spiritual 1,000, and His name's Jesus. And you and I both know that we ain't Jesus. But that doesn't give us the excuse not to go up and swing for the fence. So, it's inevitable to start anew. Don't be afraid to start anew. You may be here today and, you know, for whatever, life, choices, whatever, maybe you've drifted away from the Lord. Maybe you've drifted away from spiritual principles. How about you start new today? Behold, today's the day, the Word says. Start new. And then we move ahead. Ruth chapter 2. Now, Naomi had a relative on her husband's side. a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." And Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." You know, this is awesome because here we see Ruth saying, "Naomi, let me minister to you." Now, we don't know if Naomi just physically wasn't able to do it. I'm not sure. But Ruth says, "Listen, we have needs, and one of them is people like to eat. And let me go and make provision for you and I." And she says, "Go and do it." So she went out and entered a field and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Now, I want to take just a second to explain the process of gleaning. In the Old Testament era, what would happen was the Israelites were taught that as you're harvesting, whether it's wheat in the field or grapes from the vine or figs from the tree, don't take it all. Take the majority of it, but leave a little behind. And you see, first, what it tells you is this. It's a symbol of saying this, is that God is my provision, and He's more than enough. In some cultures in our world today, if you go there and you eat a meal with them, and you eat everything on your plate like we teach our kids here in America, what you're saying to them in their culture is, "You haven't given me enough, give me more." Where in their culture, the polite thing is to leave a little. Because in leaving a little, you say, "I am satisfied and well pleased, thank you." And so gleaning, the fields, they would leave the corners, and as they're harvesting the grain, there would be that that would kind of fall to the wayside. And they were to leave it there. And those who were in need, and those who were in transit, and these types of things. Now, this wasn't welfare. God wasn't teaching the Israelites, "You don't need to work." God gave us work, and work is productive, and all work is honorable work. But God said, "I'll provide for you." And so she says, "Let me go out and glean." And so these things were left. And so by doing this, the Israelites were saying, "God, we are well provided for by your grace and your mercy." And they would collect these things, and it would be a way of ministering to those in need. And they would go out there, and they would work along behind those that were harvesting, and they'd work the corners of the field. Or they would work the fruit that was left on the vine or the tree. It was very important. It was very productive. It had a very powerful purpose. Now, I want to give you something a little extra. Can I do that? This doesn't cost you anything. In the Bible, we see an example. In the gleaning, we see leave a little behind because you're satisfied. In the Bible, we see the process of giving first fruits. That's where the idea of the tithe comes. Bring God the first fruits. And the number you hear a lot of times is 10%. Well, that's a number. It's a great goal, but it's not set in stone. But we bring the first fruits to God, not the leftovers. And so we see this idea. And here we see an idea, we see a precedent of sharing with those in need. Whether it's time, whether it's treasure, whether it's effort, or whether in our context, the gospel of Jesus Christ. There's a precedent of always having a little extra to share. Last couple of weeks, McDonald's has been doing, it's for their Ronald McDonald House. And I've gone to McDonald's a few times, last week, about 3 weeks. And you order, and they say, "Would you like to donate a dollar to Ronald McDonald House?" Well, I'm paying with my debit card, so what's a dollar, right? I don't even see it. And you know, I said, "Yeah, I'll be happy to do that." And they add a dollar onto my bill, and I get around there, and they want to give me the little sticky heart. And I said, "Well, you just keep that. It's okay." Well, last night I picked up dinner for my son as I was going by, and they had signs up, and it says, "Thank you, thank you, thank you." And they were thanking me for giving those dollars to this project. You see, a dollar to me, what's a dollar? I mean, really. But you know, my dollar and all the other dollars can add up to great things. And I just want to say this. If we are spending every dime, and let me also say this, every minute of our lives chasing the next dime, and we don't have time, energy, or resources to share, my friends, we're out of the will of God. God never intended us to walk around with our hands clenched, saying we're too broke and we're too busy to meet the needs of others. And I challenge each and every one of you, beginning with me, that if that's where you are, we need to reevaluate and we need to consolidate and we need to be willing and ready to give as the Lord leads. It may be a dollar at a time. But you know what? It made me feel good. Because you know what? I had a dollar. And those people on the other end of that dollar who are living in that Ronald McDonald house because their little kid's laying up in ICU, they don't have that dollar. And God has blessed me. My children are healthy. I'm eating an egg white delight. I'm such a hypocrite. I laughed at that for months. But now? So my friend, my encouragement to you is this. God has given us a clear precedent. Give Him the first fruits. Don't feel like and don't live in a way that you have to spend everything that God provides for you. Be generous when need be. And you know what? It's a thousand little things that'll add up to some really great things. Let's go ahead very quickly. Even in the midst of life's trials and God's discipline, He displays love. Mara, who had said, "Call me bitter." Even in the midst of this trial, even in the midst of this discipline, God gave Mara who? Ruth. Faithful, loving, hardworking. Wow, what a precious gift. And God gave Ruth favor in the eyes of Boaz. He gave her favor as she gleaned from the field. He gave her provision to meet her physical needs and the physical needs of her mother-in-law. Even in the midst of trial or discipline, God's love will always provide. Even while we were yet sinners, even while we were yet enemies of God, the Bible says, Christ died for us. God's love always provides. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "Lord be with you. The Lord bless you," they answered. Now, wouldn't you like your boss to do that tomorrow morning? "Hey, good morning. God bless you." Some of you don't even want to see your boss in the morning. Now, I want to ask you a question. Is there someone who will be glad to see you in the morning? Huh? You bless people on Monday morning. Pick up some donuts. Be that guy. Bake some muffins tonight. Be that gal. Walk in there and just, "Hey, good morning. It's good to see you." I was at Starbucks the other day. I know you're surprised. And I walk out and the guy goes, "Okay, what are you going to have, John?" And I just looked at him and I proceeded to order. Well, one of the others walked behind him. They go, "That's Jimmy." And he goes, "Oh, it's Jimmy. It's Jimmy." He goes, "I'm so sorry." I said, "Listen, the fact that you smiled when I walked in front of you is enough. I want to walk into a room and people go, man, I'm glad he's here. I want to walk into a situation and have people go, man, I am glad Jimmy's here. I don't want to be the guy when I walk up, they go, oh, jeez. Because I'm going to tell you what, it is hard to shine Jesus when people aren't willing to even look at you. Be that person. Boaz shows up and he's greeting his workers and he's just kind of checking in on things. Boaz asks his overseer of the harvesters, "Hey, who does that young lady belong to?" Now, Ruth stood out. Now, why did she stand out? Well, we can speculate. It could have been the clothes that she wore. In many parts of the world, people are distinguished by the colors or the patterns that they wear. It could have been that just her attire made her unique from everyone else out there. It could have been that Boaz, these other people he had known for a while, and now there's a new person in amongst the crowd. It could have been that everyone else was sitting under the shade tree and she's out there working hard. You want to get recognized by the boss? You work harder than everybody else. Now it could have been that she was just good looking. Hey, prove me wrong. Read the book, prove me wrong. We don't know, but what we do know is Boaz walked up and he recognized Ruth as being unique and different. And what we see was Boaz didn't respond like others may have. Boaz had every right just to chase her smooth on out. Boaz could have treated her worse than all the others. She's a foreigner. She's an alien. You know what? Those Moabites. But he recognized her uniqueness and he responded. The overseer replied, "This is the Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi." And I'm such a jerk, I thought he's being redundant. She's a Moabite who came back from Moab. I'm a jerk, I admit it, okay? She said, "Please let me glean and gather from among the sheaves behind the harvesters." She walked up in humility. "Please allow me to do this." She came into the field and has remained here from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter. Not only did she walk up with humility and with respect, but she's worked hard. Humility, respect, and hard work will always get you noticed, if not in the eyes of man, in the eyes of God. And so he goes on, and what we're going to see as this begins to unfold, this love story begins to take place. God's provision for Ruth and Naomi, through the generosity, through the humility, through the grace, through the accepted spirit of Boaz, Ruth found favor. And my friends, if we are to share the good news of Jesus Christ with our co-workers, our family members, our athletic team members, or just that stranger sitting at a coffee table in Starbucks, we too must discipline that. We must display that. We are just sinners saved by grace, pilgrims on a journey that sometimes takes us to the mountaintops and sometimes leads us through the valleys deep. And yes, the world is uncertain and the days can be long and the nights can be dark, but one day, heaven. But until that day, as I think it was Frank Sinatra said, we never walk alone.